was recused from this case. Mr. Bianchi, good morning to you.
Morning, Judge Erickson. I had to go to these now, so. May it please the court, my name is Mike Bianchi. I'm an attorney that represents Sean McGuire. Let me be very clear with you right off the bat. Sean McGuire is not a killer. He was a drug dealer. He is a drug dealer. He's incarcerated for doing something other than that.
Is he a co-conspirator?
He's a co-conspirator in a drug distribution effort, yes. More on that in a minute, Judge Etkin. A multi-agency task force was convened back in 2009 to investigate drug distribution essentially by coming out of Mexico in the Omaha area. This task force used a man by the name of Cesar Sanchez Gonzalez, who I'll refer to as Sanchez, as an informant. Sanchez was a proprietor of the South Omaha body shop that he kind of used perhaps to do body work, but also as a front to go ahead and sell cocaine as an informant. He provided this task force with the name of an individual to whom he had sold or been involved with cocaine by the name of Abdul Van. Van was from Kansas City, and so was McGuire. About a year later, Sanchez informed the task force that Van would be coming up to investigate and perhaps purchase some more cocaine from him. This led to what the task force named Operation Sheepdog. Operation Sheepdog involved two different purported sales of cocaine. The first one occurred on September 28th. It was about 500 grams. Van was introduced to Sanchez, McGuire was introduced to Sanchez by Van, and it was determined at that time that Sanchez's source of the cocaine, this was all coming from a man named Cesar Ayala Martinez, who I'll refer to as Ayala. It went to Sanchez, then through Van down to McGuire. That first sale involved about 500 grams. The events that ultimately led to the killing of Sanchez, remember the informant, the body shop owner, took place on October 22nd, 2010. Apparently, McGuire and Van were going to get some more cocaine. They're all there, and at the time, apparently, McGuire wants to be able to either rock up the cocaine or see something about its quality, so he sends Van and another informant by the name of Jorge Palacios, who that's probably, hopefully, the last time I hear his name in my argument here. He sends them out to go and get baking soda, because that's a necessary ingredient to rock up the powder into crack. McGuire loiters in the shop for a while, and then eventually he leaves to go get something to drink. While he leaves, another gentleman by the name of Robert Knave, who McGuire had been seen earlier in the day out in front of the shop conversing with, enters the shop. When Knave comes into the shop, he's wearing a hoodie. He puts his hood over his head and he pulls out a gun. He goes in apparently to go ahead and steal the cocaine. But when he goes in, he's drawn to Sanchez, who's pulling out a gun. He takes his gun that he has, points it at Sanchez, and shoots him.
It can be inferred from your from the timing of your client leaving and the imprints of Mr. Knave?
That's what the statement suggests, obviously because it happened real close in time. Although I think the evidence in the record is that whatchamacallit actually stayed in there. McGuire actually stayed in there a number of minutes, maybe as many as 20 minutes before he actually left to go get something to drink while these other guys were off getting the baking soda. But for whatever reason, that's the inference that the state wants you to draw.
What about the money that's rolled out of paper with just bills on the outside of it? What are we supposed to infer from that?
I suppose you can infer from that he's trying to get something at a cheaper price than what he's purporting to pay for it. But
to steal the cocaine.
Or pay less for it than what they're offering to sell it for. They wanted like $40,000 for this because it was a kilo and a half. But yeah, I see where you're going, Judge Cook. In any event, when McGuire then, he's out getting into his car, he then sees Knave and another gentleman, a man by the name of Kim Thomas, who was out loitering around, start running toward the car. They all get into a car and take off together. They crash. They get caught. There's various contraband located in the car. and it was contraband that they effect, that the state effectively tied to the homicide inside the body shop. This case is important, though, not just because of what I've just told you, but it's also important because of what happened pre-trial, during trial, and on direct appeal. Before trial, McGuire is represented by an attorney by the name of Chad Brown. Brown apparently is approached or talks to the county attorney about having Mr. McGuire cooperate in his prosecution of Nate, the shooter. So, a deposition is set up. Now, common sense dictates that Brown should probably know what his client is going to say at this deposition. Either at the deposition or immediately after, a problem develops, at which time prosecutors tell Brown and McGuire, all bets are off, we're not making any deals with you or anything else like that. Eventually, Brown gets out of the case because, lo and behold, he gets rehired by the Douglas County Attorney's Office. So that in and of itself kind of smells bad, but that's not part of this.
Let me ask you about this deal, because I understand your brief. Apparently, Mr. Brown entered into a deal where, I think you indicated in your brief, had he successfully complied with that, he might be a free man today. Is that right?
Depending on the sentence he was handed down.
Isn't that what you said in your brief, that
that is
possible?
It is, and he might be.
And so according to this deal that was made by pretrial counsel Mr. Brown, your client had to give his deposition, right?
That was a part of the arrangement.
And I think you said in your brief that apparently, what did you say, there were some, apparently portions were untrue in his deposition. Did you mention that in your brief?
I mentioned that something happened at the deposition. I don't know exactly what happened, but obviously the state didn't believe McGuire.
Well, okay, I thought I read now more likely Mr. McGuire's deposition testimony was in pertinent part apparently untrue. I think
right.
That's what I read there.
That could be.
So as I understand the plea deal that was worked out, your guy would be free today if he had gone in and told the truth in the deposition.
I would have gone in, and maybe he did go in and tell the truth. But apparently he didn't go in and tell the state what he thought was the truth should be. And so the point of the matter is Brown should have known that. Brown, as his lawyer, should have known. And all of this comes up later during the trial, Judge Sampson, because at the trial, now McGuire can't testify because he's already given the deposition and given one version that the state has already told him it doesn't believe. So Brown, even Stockman, McGuire's trial counsel, admits that
he was handcuffed.
He's handcuffed.
The statement he made in the deposition, which you indicated or assumed that apparently part of it was untrue.
Right, and I want to make clear that the trial judge here, Judge Durr, inferred from the post-conviction petition that what McGuire was complaining about was that he didn't get to testify or was told by his lawyer that he shouldn't testify. Really what this is about is this whole pretrial thing where he was effectively handcuffed, to use your word, that he couldn't testify because obviously he'd given a version of events that didn't fit with the state's puzzle. So, I mean, that's one of the two primary arguments that I wanted to make to you here today.
Is that the fault of the attorney or is that the fault of Mr. McGuire?
Mr. McGuire has an attorney for a reason. I'm assuming that the attorney knows what his client's going to say before he takes him into a deposition that involves a homicide and life-threatening events.
Well, certainly, pretrial attorneys didn't tell him to go in and testify to something that, according to you, was apparently untrue.
I don't think the attorney would ever say that, no.
I agree.
But I think the attorney would say, this is their theory, and you've got to go in and tell the truth. And he should have known what McGuire would say. And if he knew that McGuire was going to go ahead and say something inconsistent with the state's theory, then they never should have gone down this road in the first place. That's just my point. And then all of a sudden...
Okay, right, so that's the foundation of ineffectiveness. You couldn't get the stink out of it.
Well, it smells. I mean, you're raising that sense.
Do you have any evidence that Mr. Brown didn't tell his client to go simply tell the truth on his purported effort to make a proffer, basically a proffer, that is, I want a deal. And if you tell the truth... then we can have a plea agreement here.
There is
anything that, any evidence that Mr. Brown did anything that was ineffective, other than, as you say, and you're claiming he didn't know what his client was going to say. If a lawyer tells his client, go tell the truth and you get this plea agreement, is there anything ineffective about that or any evidence that you have at all
know any factual allegations at all
that Mr. Brown was ineffective in any way whatsoever.
A lawyer has to know what his client's going to say under oath. But the second thing is that at the post-conviction proceeding, the only evidence that was ever offered on McGuire's behalf was his own deposition and the deposition of Stockman. Brown's deposition was never taken, which I think is meaningful as well.
Let me ask you a question. I know you're getting close here on time. Are you court-appointed or are you hired by Mr. McGuire?
Court-appointed. And I might add, I'm his fifth lawyer.
Okay. And was Mr. Troya court-appointed or was he hired?
So far as I know, he was retained.
Yeah. So your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, of post-conviction counsel, that's one of your issues.
That's argument number six in the brief.
Yeah. And this court, Supreme Court, has previously held that there is no constitutional right to effective post-conviction counsel.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay, so you rely on the statute, 29.3004.
That and its implication to use a constitutional due process.
And it provides that the district court may appoint one or two attorneys in a post-conviction.
Correct.
And it provides that if the court does that, then those are competent counsel and provide effective counsel.
Theoretically, yes.
Okay. But Mr. Troya, who you're claiming the post-conviction counsel, he was retained by Mr. McGuire. He wasn't appointed by the
district court. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning again.
May it please the Court, I'm Mayor Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. As I argued in my brief, McGuire's first three assignments of error are procedurally barred because they allege only ineffective assistance of trial counsel. In order to bring the merits of those claims to this court, it had to be raised as a layered ineffective assistance of claim. It was not done so. This is similar to the case this court recently issued a memorandum opinion on in January, State versus Richard Cook. Regarding the fourth assignment of error, however, McGuire does raise a layered ineffective claim that can be addressed on the merits by this court, and the state submits this is the only claim that is properly before this court on the merits. And regarding this fourth assignment of error, he argues that his appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to challenge trial counsel's failure to elicit testimony of the son of quarrel. The state agrees with the district court's analysis, finding that this claim is without merit. This is simply not a son of quarrel case. This court found as much on direct appeal. Nate cinched up his hoodie, pulled out a gun, and ran into the auto shop. Sanchez was shot within seconds of Nate entering the shop, and it makes no difference that Nate may have briefly pointed his gun at Eladio Martinez. Furthermore, Sanchez reaching for his gun once he saw Nate barge into the shop with a gun drawn does not amount to provocation that would justify the finding of sudden quarrel manslaughter. Nate was not provoked to use deadly force on Sanchez, and thus trial counsel was not ineffective.
Regarding to clarify your position, the conversation that we were having with opposing counsel with respect to Brown arguably being deficient, that would be encompassed by the first assignments of error.
Honestly, I'm not even quite sure
where
which
that go?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. The first assignment of error has to do with trial counsel not properly cross-examining one of the witnesses who testified at trial. The second assignment of error has to do with calling certain witnesses who could have provided testimony confirming McGuire's ignorance of the plan to rob Sanchez. And the third is in the advice given to McGuire about his rights to testify and remain silent.
So I think you may have to go to the third one. If Brown were deficient, that's where it would have been encompassed.
Yes, I think that is likely true, yes. It has to be of those three assignments of error, it would have to fit within that one. If this court would address the merits on that, as I have argued, is not appropriate, but if they would, Stockman testified that my recollection of his testimony is that the deposition was overall consistent with their theory of defense, but it still made him nervous. It made him nervous to recall him because of the chance of impeachment, and that he didn't want him to look less credible. He also thought it was not very effective to call McGuire at trial because the jury knows that McGuire is asserting his innocence, so him getting up there and saying, I didn't do it, is not very effective in trial counsel's opinion. And finally, he thought the case was going well, that he had enough for his theory of defense, and so he did advise McGuire that he should not testify, but told him again and again that this is up to you, this is your decision, if you want to testify, you can testify. Regarding the fifth assignment of error, McGuire argues that the district court failed to make findings and rule on the issues of two additional claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Once again, it is unnecessary to remand for further proceedings because the assignment of error focuses only on trial counsel claims, which is procedurally barred and is a de novo question for this court. And finally, regarding the last assignment of error of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, this court has said that post-conviction relief, state post-conviction relief, cannot be obtained on the basis of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
Have we considered that as having been raised under the statute?
Yes. My understanding, yes. In State v. Williams, it was discussed that the post-conviction statute only allows relief if it is a constitutional violation.
Not enough, but I think that this is actually a layered inquiry. Is the post-conviction statute create a statutory right for effective?
I don't know that it was assigned here.
Exploring.
I don't know that it was assigned as error as that, but our argument would be no, that post-conviction statute only provides relief if there was a constitutional error.
There seemed to be some mention of due process. Some constitutional violation of due process. Can you relate to that?
I guess I'm not certain what you're asking. If it was...
Well, I think the statute Mr. Bianchi referenced was the statute saying you're supposed to appoint competent counsel for post-conviction, and if they're incompetent counsel for post-conviction, then there's a due process issue.
Okay. Well, I don't... Once again, this was apparently not appointed counsel, so it would not apply in this case. But I don't know that the statute provides an additional remedy. I think, once again, it comes back to, as this court has said repeatedly, post-conviction relief cannot be obtained on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think it goes back to that, and I don't think you can say otherwise. Unless this court has questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We do not. Mr. Bianchi, thank you for your service. This concludes arguments for today. The court is adjourned and you are excused.